Kurt mad at me. Good morning. I am going to open a public hearing on House Bill 5071. This is the subcommittee. Whoops. Yeah. I'm sorry. This is the Subcommittee on General Government. Today is Wednesday, March the 9th, and we have before us the Treasurer. Good morning, Mr. Treasurer.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
And would invite you to begin your presentation, even though we are convening a subcommittee of the subcommittee. And if you wouldn't mind starting.
Great. Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Randall Edwards, State Treasurer of Oregon, and I'm proud to be here to present the Oregon State Treasury to you. With me is Linda Haglund, my deputy, who will go over our programs, performance measurements, and the budget information that you had requested. I want to take a couple minutes to give you a sense of what we do for Oregonians and how we do our job. Let me first begin by giving you a sense of the size and the scope of our financial responsibilities. The Treasury is the largest financial institution in Oregon. Let me repeat that. It is the largest financial institution in Oregon. Our work directly or indirectly impacts every household in the state. We're responsible for annual transactions over $134 billion run through our banking system. We manage a portfolio of assets of $62 billion. In fact, the state's pension fund hit a record $48 billion last year, and it was seen as the 24th largest fund of its size, private or public, in the country, larger than ExxonMobil, AT&T, DuPont, Chrysler, states like Texas, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania. The Common School Fund is now a record $900 million. And when I took office 4 years ago, I opened the first account in the Oregon College Savings Plan, which had no money. Today, we oversee $400 million in the Oregon College Savings Plan network. And as a central issuer of all state obligations, I oversee a total portfolio of $8.7 billion.
Mr. Treasurer, when you say network, what do you mean? The Oregon College Savings Plan network. I just didn't understand that.
Sure. The entire program is called the network. We have two providers. The Oregon College Savings Plan is a direct sold product that we sell to Oregonians. They can go online, call us. We can send them information. It's a direct sold product. We also sell another a product through MFS, which is sold through brokers, and those two combined are called the network. So we have a network of providers.
You've given us the aggregate dollar amount in the program. How many families in Oregon have taken advantage of it, or how many, I shouldn't say families because I'm sure there are intergenerational purchasers, but how many Oregonians are served by it?
Maybe, Michael, you could answer a specific number. I'll have Michael Parker from the program come up and give you a specific family number.
Madam Chair, for the record, Michael Parker, the Executive Director of the network. We have about 60,000 accounts in the network, network-wide. That represents probably nearly about 30,000 Oregon families taking advantage of those 60,000 accounts. On average, each family has about 1.9 accounts.
1.9 accounts.
Yeah. So if you have a couple of kids, we can't use one family, but you actually have two accounts.
It's kind of like FTE. You don't have a full you can have 2.3 FTE, et cetera.
So, particularly in this debate that is raging in this building about tuition costs and preparation for college, this seems to be an unusually attractive tool for families that are planning for college.
And I'm also proud that we're in every county in Oregon, so we're not just centralized in one area. We really worked hard to get every Oregonian to at least see it and try to make sure people throughout the state invest in it if they have an opportunity. Great.
Thank you,
Michael. I'll just be brief, and we can have a discussion about anything else you want about our budget and some of the work we do, but I wanted to say that we've been successful in managing this growing responsibility, the billions that I just cited, by attracting and retaining and developing a high-quality workforce and having solid back-office support. We also make sure that we have good-performing private partners to help us execute our business. We constantly evaluate those partnerships on their performance and cost basis and terminate those that do not meet our expectation. We have a national reputation of being a very good money manager, and in the financial world, people seek to have Oregon on their list of, as a client. And unfortunately, that's caused a lot of people coming to our door asking for their business. We live, though, in a very complicated world. The markets we work in, whether it's the stock market, international, private equity, banking, or municipal bond market, they are all very complex and dynamic, and new products and services come out each year. We also have found ourselves confronted with new challenges like corporate governance issues following the collapse of Enron, WorldCom, Tyco, the mutual fund scandals, and the problems with the New York Stock Exchange. The Treasury has had a long history of managing itself very well in these rough and tumble in this rough and tumble world. Our success comes from our strategic priorities to provide financial leadership, attract, develop, and retain a diverse, high-quality workforce, be customer-focused, and seek innovative solutions. We also know that what we do today has a long-term impact on the state and our customers. Thus, the culture in the Treasury is one where we constantly work to anticipate the future to find value today. Or, as our vision statement reads, financial leadership today for Oregon's tomorrow. I've worked at the Treasury for more than 8 years, 4 years as a staff member and 4 years as a treasurer. It is a remarkable organization that has long served Oregon and its citizens well, and I'm honored to be part of that history. I'd like to turn this over to Linda Haglund, who will give you more detailed information about our programs, the performance measurements, and the budget information that you'd requested. And I look forward to working with you on our budget request and to ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Treasurer. And I just want to say before Linda starts how courteous she was to come to my office and walk through your presentation materials. I've had the privilege of hearing your budget before, and I've always been very impressed with the level of work that you put into informing the legislature about the Treasury. So I just want to,
Thank you. In front
of your boss, acknowledge what a good job you do.
Duly noted.
Yep. Great. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Linda Haglund, Deputy State Treasurer. And actually, I might just ask you, Madam Chair, how you'd like me to proceed.
I think you probably, I was just, as the Treasurer was speaking, while still hanging on every word, I was just thumbing ahead and looking at the presentation materials. I just go ahead the way you have them laid out here.
Okay. So
I think what we want to cover today is the high-level overview. We want to the degree we're able to move through it, get through your priorities, your performance measures, and if we're able to conclude that today, great.
All right, I think we should be able to. So why don't I do this? Let me now go into our programs, and I'll just cover them very quickly, and if there's any program in particular you'd like me to drill down a little bit more on and give you more information, so I'll stay very high level. So this is actually in our notebook on page 3. The first program that you're going to see is one that's actually new in our reporting to the legislature, and that's the State Land Board. And it's actually there because of the process of prioritizing our programs. As we went through them, we realized in looking at what was driving programs in Treasury, were they statutory, were they constitutional, we needed to capture the State Land Board because certainly this is a program that has duties in the Treasury. State Treasurer sits on the State Land Board, and hence we also support that program. The Treasurer sits with, obviously, the Governor and the Secretary of State. I'd have included in the handbook there, in the notebook, the actual mission per the Constitution for that particular program.
Maybe I could interject here. And while that's new, it's not new to the organization. And,
right.
And I think what was important for us to bring forward was this is a important part of my job, and we get no support money-wise to run whatever time and staff time it takes to make sure that I am a very active and involved participant. And I do have a staff person who does help me assist on this mandated function of mine. And I think it's a really important one and one that I have taken very seriously, and it does take a lot of time. There are a lot of issues that I didn't even raise in my testimony but are non-financially related that take an enormous amount of time.
I think, though, and again, I would turn to the professional staff for correction, but I don't think the governor's staff has money for land board participation. I don't think the Secretary of State does either. I think that it's useful that you pointed out what a significant responsibility this is for the three individuals that comprise the land board, and it's something that I think we should bring back for the consideration of the committee, just to make sure that the committee is completely aware of the fact you're discharging these responsibilities and absorbing the costs.
Maybe just one other point. Because it's a quorum of three, we communicate, the three of us, by our staff, so we cannot have dialogue. So right. Therefore, it complicates and actually adds additional time because it's a lot of staff time that requires to get the bosses talking about something and then working through staff. So it is fairly labor-intensive.
Am I reading too much into your comments to suggest that maybe there's a better way to do this, or you're just pointing out to the legislative body that this is a significant responsibility that comes without significant money?
The latter. And you wanted us to prioritize, and we obviously this was one that I don't think we'd ever really presented before in this way, and I think that's important for, as you pointed out, for the legislature to know the three of us have this job. It's very important. It has been around since the state was created, and we spend a lot of time on it.
Thank you. Go ahead, Linda.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. The rest of the programs in Treasury are statutory programs, and I think you'll see the overriding theme of them is they really are all financially related, and hence the theme that we always say is that we're the financial infrastructure of the state, in a sense that the back office for the state. Running through those quickly, the investment program is statutory and it serves local governments and state agencies. The treasurer's highlighted some of the programs that we manage there, PERS funds, as well as the Common School Fund. We manage money for SAFE. The total portfolio that's managed by the investment program is, at year-end, $61.6 billion. The treasurer's noted that the retirement fund is about 43, I think you actually used 48 is the new number, and that ranks us in the top 24 in the country. Oversight for the investment programs really come from two different boards. The Oregon Investment Council, which has been around since 1967, so it's a long-time body of assisting the treasurer in managing the funds and the treasurer executing the directions of the council. They have oversight for all the funds that you see listed there. The second board that provides oversight for some of our funds is the Oregon Growth Account Board, and this particular board controls the Oregon Growth Account.
Could you, just for my benefit, mm-hmm. drill down on that Oregon Growth Account a little bit? It's an area in your budget that I've struggled with during my entire service in the legislature. Describe it a little bit. Talk about it in slightly more detail.
Well, the Oregon Growth Account itself is funded through lottery dollars. And the objective of the fund is to earn a return on venture capital investing to ultimately return earnings to the currently the HET fund, the Higher Education Tech Transfer Fund. So that's the mission of the program.
I don't recall the name of the number of the bill, but there is a bill coming through this session in a suite of bills that would consolidate some of the acronym-rich organizations. And this is, thank you,
Stop.
Mr. Treasurer.
I saw the warning sign.
Acronym-free zone.
Yeah.
But would amalgamate some of those acronym-rich organizations. And now I'm going to launch into acronymies. Mm-hmm. ETIC, OCED, HEP. How would that affect your management of the Oregon Growth Account were that bill to pass?
Madam Chair, actually the management of the fund wouldn't be affected. Those bills are focused on what happens to the earnings.
Okay.
So it's just where we would direct the earnings.
Okay.
But to answer your question specifically, that bill would not have an impact on that work. And that's just a reorganization of the alphabet soup to try to align. As you know, we both sit on that group to try to align some effort to make investments and strategies long-term for the state.
As long as this is somewhat informal and I get to ask all the questions.
You seem to have
that advantage this morning.
I've just come from a meeting talking about Oregon Economic and Community Development and how they're organized and what their structure is and what they should be doing as an agency to deliver economic stimulation for the state. And it seems to me that we have a lot of high-tech initiatives distributed in a kind of thin veneer in a lot of places. Do you have any recommendation, and I know I haven't prepared you for this question, and I apologize, it's just conversation right now, any thoughts about where some of this high-tech initiative ought to reside in terms of what constitutes economic development in this very esoteric area of high-tech?
It's a very good question. I don't know if I can give you a good answer right now, but I think in some ways the consolidation we described in that bill is trying to get a government.
Let me just interrupt you, Mr. Chair, if you don't. I mean, Mr. Treasurer, if you don't mind, the chair of the Economic Development Committee has come in.
Well, you can answer that.
Well, no, I am just eager to have him know the question and listen to your answer. What I have asked, apropos our discussions about the structure of OECDD and what work that Oregon Economic and Community Development ought to be delivering on behalf of Oregonians, we are discussing on page 3, and that's where we are so that you all can get caught up. Ms. Hagland is going through their programmatic areas, describing the work inside those programs, and we got to the Oregon Growth Account Board. And I was querying, given that we have high-tech initiatives scattered in a lot of places, where is the appropriate repository for this knowledge-based economy? Should it be within the purview of Oregon Economic and Community Development because they're, quote-unquote, creating jobs and stimulating the economy? Should it, because of its level of sophistication and complication, reside in a place that is more along the line of a banker mentality and a an account management mentality and a venture capital mentality? I'm just trying to get your opinion about should we have lots of high technology initiatives scattered in a lot of places, or should we put them in one place, and what's your opinion about where that place should be?
And you also didn't mention higher ed. I mean,
that too.
They seem to have a role in this as well.
Yeah.
I don't know. Again, I'm not trying to dodge the question. I do think trying to find one place makes some sense. And out of that, I mean, really, in the end, the governor's office, I think, has the ultimate responsibility here to try to coordinate, because everything we've talked about, I mean, we have a piece of this, whether it's the Oregon Growth Account, and I sit on that board with you, the Oregon Investment Fund, which we put together, and our approach to looking at investments in Oregon. But technology is such a broad, and venture capital, or venture investing in technology is such a broad group that I do think you do want to find one area that you'd want to house that, and then from that have the oversight into, you know, working with us or whomever. And I do think in many ways it should reside with the governor, because long-term, this is a long-term play. And not having thought that out and whether that's something they're interested in, and that could be through the Economic Development Department, but I don't know if they reach broad enough. You know, higher ed, as you know, can be a morass of interests that they may not be able to work with, so you need to get a coordinating effort there.
Well, and what I'm driving at is that, and perhaps I'm erroneous in this thinking, but this is an area of investment that is much more complex than advancing a package of operating loans to a motor coach manufacturer, deciding what technological opportunities could survive in a venture capital environment, how to bring some of these new technologies to market. It is an extremely high risk, high volatility, great degree of sophistication, and I'm just trying to figure out where's the most appropriate place for Oregonians, where the state's initiatives in this arena should reside so that they get the kind of sophisticated management and oversight and funds dispersal commensurate with the risk involved.
Well, how you describe that would probably lend itself to look at our office having some role in that, if not the role. If you're drilling into the investment side, I mean, and it's more than just that, but the technical side, we have staff that work in this field, but we also have
resources in terms of consultants and people we hire to manage money. In fact, that's the way the Oregon Growth Account ultimately got set up over time, was to have a board, which is the way we manage the Oregon Investment Council, have an overseeing board, and then hiring managers with expertise to help us. So it is more of a banking function, I think, to look and try to drill into those investment opportunities, because in the end, you want to make money. You want it to be successful, and success requires you to have look at those opportunities as something that will grow.
Well, and I guess just to the risk of beating this to death, the other question is that in the last session, where funds were committed in such a way as to be invested in Oregon companies, I think some of us were of the opinion that it's not just good enough to be Oregon. You've got to be a company with proper fundamentals. And where is the appropriate place for decisions to be made about those level of investments, where the opportunity will have survived the most rigorous scrutiny to make the best investment and lessen the risk for public money? And so I didn't really expect you to have an answer, no, Mr. Treasurer, and I don't mean to put you on the spot. It just was an opportunity to engage in this discussion.
Well, it highlights, your question really highlights how we do our business, and I do think we would have a role in that. We do today, and we would, and I think I'd be, we'd certainly want to talk to you about how, and with the governor's office, what is the best strategy? How might we maybe work more closely with OECD, or if he, in the end, somebody, but you're going to have to pull a lot of loose strings together, right? I mean, you've got higher ed, you've got the business community. In some ways, that board that we sit on has that kind of overview, if you will, but I don't know if they're empowered, which is, you know, one of the challenges of making sure that they have some authority. But I do think that we would have a role in that.
Clearly. Well, in the interest of moving on, I'm going to ask Dallas, if he would, to just flag that as something, sure, that we'd come back and talk about in the more in-depth phase of this budget, to just see where's the appropriate spot for some of this high-tech stuff to reside. So, Ms. Hagelin, now that the committee is coming up to strength, I'm going to ask you to continue. She's on page 4,
exactly,
walking through the different programmatic areas inside Treasury.
Great. And Madam Chair, members of the committee, what we had decided is I would just touch on this at a high level, and if you had any questions, then we could drill down a little bit more. So moving on to page 4, our banking program. Actually, it's a statutory program serving all state agencies, and actually we have over... And let me stop and go back a moment there. All state agencies must bank with the Treasury. So it's a requirement that they come through our services. Local governments are not required to use state Treasury services, but having said that, we have over 1,000 local governments who avail themselves of services that we make available to them. Our banking program is central as far as its services for the state, and because of that, we do receive economies of scale and are able to drive cost-saving programs out to the agencies. So there's a real advantage of having a central bank for the state. As the treasurer mentioned earlier, but I do want to restate, in our banking program, we have over $134 billion dollars running through those systems every year.
Do you go out and market your services to local government to tell them what's available in terms of your customer service?
We do in terms of, Madam Chair, we do in terms of the services of the short-term fund, the local government investment pool, and we do that through the short-term, the Oregon short-term
fund board.
Right. Thank you. OSTFB, and I had to think of the letters to get right, to get the meaning. So we do not actively market, but we do through our involvement with those particular products.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Good question.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the banking industry, top management, president, vice president, CEO, CFO, are required to take mandatory time off from their job every year. Usually it's 5 to 10 working days. How do you folks, and the reason for that is if someone is playing with the system fraudulently in a period of days, being automated, it's going to kick out. How do you folks protect your financial record keeping to ensure that those type of situations don't occur, and that situation isn't needed in the public sector?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith. Actually, it's through our internal controls is how we address that. I am vaguely familiar with the banking requirement, and I'm not sure actually how it's applied today, if it's across the board or if it's just targeted positions. But
it's anyone who has cash handling authority is required to take a very specific amount of time. If you're the president of the bank, it's 10 days consecutive. If you're a CFO, it's 10 days, but if you're a branch manager, it's 5.
The way we approach it is internal to the agency itself, to Treasury, is again through our internal controls and internal audit process in managing separation of duties as well as after the fact.
But banks have.
They do.
Banks have internal auditors mm-hmm. and internal controls.
Mm-hmm. You know, I might, our finance division director is here, and he would have more of that banking perspective and might be able to add something.
Sure. I don't want to take the time, Madam Chair. I just, if it makes sense in the private sector lending institutes, whether big or small, I'm just trying to figure out why it doesn't make sense for the state. And you're about the fourth agency I've asked this question of.
Can we have Darren come up?
Good morning. Would you state your name for the record, please?
For the record, I'm Darren Bond, the Director of Finance for the Oregon State Treasury. Ms. Chair, Representative Smith, a couple things. One is that we don't have an issue with staff not taking time off. We have a staff that is quite seasoned and is very well cross-trained. And so we don't, for instance, our duties relative to electronic funds transfers, both in the ACH arena and in the wire transfer arena, are not dependent on one person, and which is an issue and an opening for embezzlement. And we have a great deal of cross-training and a great deal and different people working through those positions. We have internal controls where all accounts are reconciled by someone other than who is responsible for those financial, those transaction-related activities.
Why don't we do this, Madam Chair, because I don't want to take too much time on this. I've got a piece of legislation that would require 5 consecutive days off. Perhaps I could send it to you.
Sure.
And I would just be interested in your take on it, because I think everything you're sharing with me is also in Bank of America. You know, in terms of internal controls, cross-training, separation of duties. And we'll talk about it.
Sure.
I'd just like to get your take on it, whether it makes sense to protect the state.
I would also point out one other thing, and that is all of our money is actually at those institutions, so that we're availing ourselves of their internal controls as well.
Okay. Well, maybe afterwards you and I can get together and talk.
Thank you. Once again, Ms. Agnew, please continue.
If I can highlight in the banking program, our role to agencies is to provide centralized services to them and improve their efficiencies. And a couple of programs that came out just this year that lend credence to that work is internally we developed a program to deliver banking statements over the Internet. And that has allowed, of course, much more timely delivery of information, reduction in paper, and it's also provided, in a sense, I don't want to say query, that's a bit more robust, but ability for agencies to take those reports and drill down into them much more efficiently than flipping through paper copies. We've gotten tremendous response back from local governments and state agencies using that program. In fact, just this week, an entity in Harney County came online and sent a note and said that they thought it was awesome. I wanted to share that with you. Additionally, we, over the last couple of years, have had a pilot program with Employment Department using stored value cards. And these are cards that are issued that get charged whatever frequency the payment is, so let's say monthly, with funds. And then the individual takes that card to their financial institution or to a point of purchase, like a debit card. And Employment Department has estimated that they're looking at $2 to $2.5 million in savings per year from a banking function standpoint, just from their use of the program. And I'll do a little plug here. We have House Bill 2030 in the works that would make this a payment that's available for any agency to avail themselves of, a payment form. So instead of writing a check, there's a list of payment types that can be used. It would add stored value cards as an option for them. So that would bring it into more use in other agencies in the state. And that's what I had to say on the banking program. Any other questions you might have there? Madam Chair, I'll move on then to debt management program. I think it's one that we're quite visible with you individually and also with our agency partners as they look to issue debt in the state. It's a statutory program, and again, this is a centralized function that we have. Programs themselves reside out in the agencies where the programs are run. Treasury acts as that central point to rationalize our entry into the marketplace such that we don't have state issuing bonds in competition with local governments or even in competition with itself. We also work with all the state agencies to make sure that the state is being presented to our rating agencies in a manner that presents our best foot forward and hopefully keeps our rating, the state bond rating, as high as possible. We do support a number of boards, and you'll see those on page 4, the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission, which has been around since 1975, the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission, which actually provides advice to the legislature in state bonding. That's been around since 1997. The Private Activity Bond Committee, 1985, and the Oregon Facilities Authority, 1989.
Ms. Hagelin, who is your appointing authority for all of these commissions?
A number of them are, it's a mixed bag. The treasurer, as well as the governor, has appointment. And I think the legislature appoints the state policy.
So it's a myriad, but there are a number of boards we didn't really. Well, you'll see throughout here that I have some authority appointing the boards, the governor, the legislature mandates a certain number of people to serve.
Would you like some detailed information on
that? Actually, I would, only because appointments to boards has been a hot topic in this building in the last couple of weeks, and I think the next 72 hours will be an interesting opportunity to discuss all of these. Oregon has had a long tradition of citizens stepping forward to serve in advisory capacities to state agencies. And if you wouldn't mind providing to the professional staff so that they could provide it to the committee members, the names of all the folks that serve on your advisory committees, because until you did this display, which I might add is a very helpful display, to know just exactly where your responsibilities are, from what source you derive your authority, I hadn't been aware that you had this many advisory boards.
And I wanted to just touch on that. Like I said earlier, having good qualified staff, and as you just highlighted, having good qualified people serving on these boards who are willing to spend the time is really important for us. And I think we've had a long success of getting working with the legislature, the governor, or in my case, where I can direct people who are serving at the capacity that we would hope they can serve at. But as you know, it can be very challenging to get people with time.
And Madam Chair, just so we can be fully responsive, you asked the question when we're discussing debt management. Would you like all of our
I'd
boards?
Like all of them, please.
Great.
Yeah,
we'll get great, them. Great.
And who the appointing authority is.
Please.
Mm-hmm. Great. And debt management, this is the group that brought School Bond Guarantee Act to the state a number of years ago, tax anticipation notes, pension obligation bonds, and swaps. So this is the team that is bringing those tools for our use. Then moving to page 5, the Oregon Short-Term Fund Program. Really, this is the second part of centralized cash management in the state. I talked about banking just a few minutes ago. Short-term fund is a money market account that is open to local governments as well as state agencies for short-term cash to be placed in there. The fund right now, as of actually the end of December, $8.8 billion. roughly half of that money is state money and about half of that is local government money. We'll get into the performance measures. I have a breakdown of that for you. Madam Chair, back to your earlier question about local governments, this is where the Oregon Short-Term Fund Board sits, and it actually is a liaison to the Oregon Investment Council, providing guidance of the investment of the short-term fund, and it also reviews investment policies for local governments. Moving on to the Oregon 529 College Savings Network, you heard a moment ago from Michael Parker, the executive director of that program. This is the 529 tax-advantaged plan for saving for college. It started in 1-1 of 01, actually with its first dollar, as a result of action in the 1999 legislature. It's a very popular program with over 60,000 accounts now and just under $400 million in the program as of year end. The final program is the collateral pool, and this is a program that when local governments or state agencies have money below $100,000 on deposit with a financial institution, they have the FDIC insurance. When it's in excess of the insured portion, it needs to be collateralized. And the collateral pool is the method by which those deposits are collateralized.
Question?
Representative Smith.
How do you collateralize them?
How do we collateralize them?
Yeah.
From a security standpoint or the actual mechanics?
No, from a security perspective. What backs the collateral?
They are Treasury securities, AAA
okay.
securities
Thank
on
you.
Deposit.
Thanks.
Great. And with that, our final program is the Oregon Council for Knowledge and Economic Development, also known as OCED. That was set up in statute in 2001, and the treasurer has already talked a little bit about OCED. I'd be happy to answer any more questions about that program or any of the other programs of Treasury.
Okay.
Great. On the next page, page 7, is just a very, on one page, we're a fairly small agency. Relative to some of them that you hear, we have 75 folks working for us. That's 74.6 FTE. This is our organization chart. No questions there. I'd like to turn then to our prioritization of programs under tab 2 and ask the chair how she'd like me to proceed with this.
I think just follow your laid out presentation.
Great. I'd like to just first state that these programs really, as I've highlighted for you, are the financial infrastructure for the state. And as such, it was a very difficult task for Treasury to go through and actually prioritize programs that each and every one of them provides a service that needs to continue. The bank has to be there. Or your Treasury Department has to be there for your business to operate. Having said that, we did go through the process and did prioritize our programs. Before I go into it, let me just talk to you a little bit about the table itself so you'll understand how we went through the ranking. The priority is our 7 programs, ranked 1 through 7. Then we did use 3 different criteria for ranking. The first one is financial, high, medium, and low is the HML. And our criteria there was either dollars earned or dollars saved, so just leverage of dollars. The second criteria was the customers and stakeholders that we touched. And on this particular measure, we actually looked through who are we serving. So not just at the state agency level, but how did that play out for Oregonians. The third criteria, state government versus local government versus non-government activity, this was a much more narrow focus of looking at who did we directly interface with. So forgetting who was being served ultimately by the program, but who were we working with. As a result of that, let me just walk through a couple of them for examples. Priority number 1 was constitutional. By default, we had no choice. So that became priority number 1. It's a very important program. But we took the easy one and put it number 1. The rest of the programs, we did go through the process of the criteria, and you can see, for instance, in the investment program, financial is marked high. We earn a lot of dollars for the state relative to the expenditure of state assets to run that program. We touch a great number. In fact, it would actually be all Oregonians, all taxpayers, because ultimately they are the ones that pay the rates for PERS as they're using state services, in effect. Also, the high earnings of the program impact the ability of SAFE, comma, school fund, et cetera, to be able to distribute more money, keep their premiums low. The third criteria, state government versus local versus non-government, you can see that's 100% on state government. Our interface is to PERS the agency, is to SAFE the agency. So that's the example of just who we're touching. Banking, same type of thing there. Dollars earned, this is more of a dollar saved because of our efficient and cost-effective services that we offer. Customers, not quite so many out there because it's a bit more narrow in the local government sector. And then when you're looking at the actual who do we touch, the bulk of our interface is with state agencies, and we do have some contact with local governments. So that's the process that we went through. I won't go through the rest of the programs, but functionally, that's the order that we went through, and then that drove the 1 through 7 ranking.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Senator Morsad.
Thank you. This may be a naive question, but as far as the state land board is concerned and the leasing of state lands under the control of the state to various individuals or companies, I noticed that the land within the 3-mile limit, which contains lots and, at the coast, where people do a lot of crabbing and fishing and so on and so forth, the state does not really do anything with that land. Is there a reason? There must be a reason.
Maybe you could clarify your question. I mean, we don't do anything. I mean,
We don't. There are no, as far as I know, there are no leasing agreements with people. There are no permits. Well, maybe you do have a crabbing permit, but I know that that's where a lot of the crab pots, commercial crab pots, are set. It's state-controlled land, just like grazing land and so on. But I noticed that we have no agreements with anyone to take advantage of the resources. There are resources on that land. I imagine if we ever drilled for oil within a 3-mile limit, we would take advantage of that. And thank God don't. But I'm just curious, and if you don't.
Let me get back to you on why we... I mean, there is a history there. I'm not sure I know the answer to that right now, why that is. We do take fees, for example, when fiber cables are drawn up on a beach, and we charge a fee for that.
Yeah, and I saw that.
We're trying to remove a wreck off the coast that is our problem, and we did win a $25 million judgment, and we're still in court over that, but we're trying to clean that up.
Well, I remember when I did commercial fishing in 1980, and I believe that was the year that the... boats from the East Coast came out to get scallops off the Oregon coast, and it was within the 3-mile limit, and there were several huge factory boats out there dragging the bottom to take away all of our scallops, right. And I think that they probably...
I'll get an answer to you on that in the history. I just don't know it.
Yeah, okay.
I'm sure it's a very complicated answer.
Wondered.
Delicate.
Did you ever do commercial fishing, Representative?
Senator, I have never done so. Just commercial farmer.
Oh, I see.
My brother was a commercial fisherman.
I've never noticed you wearing a commercial fishing outfit.
I know.
On the floor
I've done too many things.
Moving right along with the presentation. Please continue, Ms. Harris.
Yes. If we could turn to tab 3, which is our performance.
Actually, I'm going to stop you before we go to...
Great.
I noticed you didn't list in priority the other programs, the OCED initiative. How come?
Okay, it's 8.
That is...
right answer. I was just curious if there was some...
it's an oversight.
That's fine.
I would put it as 8.
Thank you. Now we can move to page 3.
Can I ask one more question?
Please, Representative.
all the different commissions and committees, do they, and you may have said this and I just missed it, do they fall within, are they independent of these different programs, or are they all somehow tied to these different programs?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, no, they're all tied to the program. The program that they're listed with.
Okay. So the different committees and commissions that you're going to get us a list of, somehow they tie to 1 through ACE?
Every one of them.
Okay, mm-hmm. Thank you.
Save OCED, and I won't go through all the...
I have it as number 8.
Correct.
And we're granting acronym...
Yes, thank you. There is amnesty.
Absolutely. Yeah. acronym amnesty on OCED. That's how that works.
I don't want to say it. We'd be here for hours.
Yeah. Right.
Okay, we're on tab 3.
Tab 3. So our performance measures, and I'll ask the chair here, would you like me to go through each one of them, highlight one per program?
I think given that we still have enough time, we're moving along expeditiously, let's start going through the whole list, and at the point that it appears that we've got the essence of your display, then we could maybe move on, but let's begin.
And I'll look to you to alert me to that.
I will.
All right. So on page 10... The first group of measures relate to the investment program, and the first measure that you see is the performance of the retirement fund, OPERF. And what we're showing here is excess return of the portfolio relative to benchmarks. And what I might do right off the bat is explain a little bit about the chart and how it works. You're going to see on the left axis dollars in millions, and that axis ties to the bars, and the right axis is percentages, and that ties to the lines. So you know the two you're looking at.
Maybe I could just add a little flavor here. I mean, in fact, today in the press they were talking about the PERS decision, and there's a reference to the stock market, and you know, the swings of the stock market have impacted negatively and positively. That is true, but what really this shows is two things. One, and you'll see, we have a diversified portfolio. It's not just the stock market. It's actually the way we approach the market. It's a diversified portfolio. But this chart really, I think, highlights how we've been very a high-performance organization and return-driven is we add value above what the markets are providing, and that... Over time, just last year, we exceeded all of our benchmarks in all of the categories we're invested in this fund, which contributed to having an excess return over, quote, the market, which was huge. And I think it was $2 billion we calculated.
The you actually, basis. If I might just jump in right there and just point out on the chart that shows those numbers.
Okay.
So on the top chart, the treasurer's just referring Madam Chair, members of the committee, to our performance last year. And you'll see the bar for 2004. So the performance of the total retirement fund, OPERF, its performance over the benchmarks that the Oregon Investment Council set for the different segments of the portfolio, the excess that the Treasury, in execution of those guidelines, added to OPERF in 2004, that's 700.
That's right.
Right. 731.050. Right. Millions. So over $700 million last year in excess performance. If you look longer term, as the treasurer mentioned, this is a long-term portfolio. The chart that you're seeing on the bottom of page 10 shows rolling 3-year periods ending each of these calendar periods that you see. So for instance, in 2004, there's not much space between those two marks, but it makes a big difference in return. Rolling 3 years, that difference is 0.62 percentage points of performance. That equates to over $700 million of value added.
One of the points here is even though when the market went down, we didn't go down as far as the market as a portfolio, and therefore we still added value long term. And that's a nuance, but it's really why this state has had the national reputation of being a good money manager. We don't chase returns. We keep to our investment strategy. We don't, if something swings out of balance, we don't sell off that asset and try to jump into something else. We actually stay and, in fact, reinvest in that because at some point we know long-term it turns around. So that's really, I know this is kind of, these charts are hard to read, but that's really the essence here is we have added value.
Madam Chair,
could you
give for us, and I was just looking through your ensuing charts here, and I don't see anything that shows us in relation to this chart your total OPERF assets. Could you provide us with a chart that could show us that? Because I think it would be an interesting visual to see your total assets as in relation to your returns, especially in the 2003 year where the returns were so deeply in the negative side. It would be very helpful.
So just for clarification, just the total amount of assets in each of these periods.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Not a problem.
Thank you.
Thank you. And again, if you'd give it to the professional staff, then they can distribute it to the whole committee.
Sure. No problem. Thank you. So moving along then, I've highlighted the aggregate portfolio. What you're going to see in the ensuing charts are the sub-asset classes. And I'd be happy to just quickly run through those and give me a holler if you want me to talk about any one of them in particular.
Go ahead.
Thematically, each of the charts are built the same. These are the returns of the portfolios named in the title. For instance, OPERF Domestic Equities Funds. So this is the U.S. Money market or money managers for the fund. It's the performance of the fund over the benchmark for that particular fund. And as you'll see, the benchmark is identified as the Russell 3000. So those are our one-year returns fund to benchmark. Since I've talked about alpha, domestic in 2004, we added there $168 million of excess performance. International, the same methodology being presented. The alpha for 2004, $5.2 million. Turning the page to page 12, alternatives. We have, again, the same methodology being presented, $286 million. Our real estate portfolio, alpha for 2004, 218. Fixed income, 127 in 2004. And the short-term fund, which is actually the piece that's it's our money market account, our cash management account, just under $10 million for 2004.
Just to also add something here, that the benchmarks that we put out are ones where we work with outside consultants who help develop these benchmarks. I mean these aren't anything we're just cooking up. These have been vetted, and that's why, with confidence, I can tell you we have done a very good job against these benchmarks. And that's what we're trying to show, is that these benchmarks have been established. We measure ourselves against them. We measure our managers against them. If they're not, as I mentioned, if they're not performing, they will leave.
May I?
Senator Morsett.
Thank you. Randall, Treasurer. Mr. Treasurer. I imagine that each person that holds your office, I know that this is a joint decision-making process in which funds to stick with if they're on the downswing, they don't sell and try to chase something that may or may not come out. Is this a reflection of your personal philosophy? Does the treasurer bring this to the office and is able to then implement that philosophy, so to speak?
The answer is yes. I mean, the treasurer, with my staff,
with your staff,
and as I said earlier, the culture in our organization is a long-term culture. That is, we look out, which translates into how we as an organization, through my leadership or the treasurer's leadership, really execute our required mandates. And so there's a patience in my organization, which I think is well embedded. So the next treasurer will also have that luxury of having this organization that looks out long-term, whether we're selling bonds for 15 to 20 years, investing for perpetuity. I mean, these funds, OPERF fund, will be around for years and years and years, much longer than you and I. And that's sometimes, I think, one of the distinguishing differences between the way we manage money and as an institutional investor, is we see this lasting forever, quite frankly.
individuals, we all know we have a lifetime, and we will invest certain strategies more aggressively, and as we get older towards retirement and in retirement, we become more conservative. You don't do that here. You constantly look at your investment portfolios and approaches and look long-term, and we lose value with the markets going down, ebb and flow, but because we have an asset allocation, we look at different strategies, put them together, and stick to that. And that has actually been a very long-term approach that this benefited the state and our beneficiaries and our clients. So, yes, the treasurer has a role, a very important role, to keep that long-term perspective, and I think we've done a very good job with that.
Please go ahead.
I have a question.
Oops.
Sorry, my apologies, Madam Chair, for not being more quick. In talking about your short-term fund returns, did I hear you correctly say that was about $10 million?
Yes, in 2004, the return of the fund over the benchmark, which is a three-month Treasury bill.
Okay, that's over the benchmark. So what is the total amount of short-term interest that we earn in 2004, and where does that money go?
I'd have to get back to you, Madam Chair, with the exact number of the interest. It'd be roughly the fund, if we wanted to do kind of a hypothetical, 1%, just rounding down, and the fund's about $8 billion. So we can do the math there. Where do the earnings go? They're actually credited to the participants in the Oregon Short-Term Fund. So it's state and local governments that have money deposited in the short-term fund. And it's proportional to the deposits, just like a regular bank account.
And Madam Chair, are there instances where interest accumulation from short-term, this type of a short-term account, is such that it should be credited, or is it credited to the general fund, or would it become available to the general fund?
Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, if you followed through the ownership of the account, some of the interest could go to the general fund, but it would be driven by the owner of the account. That would not be a function of Treasury as an agency directing funds. Is that being responsive?
Madam Chair, where I'm headed with this is I would like to know an accounting of those dollars that could possibly be credited to the state of Oregon, the taxpayers of the state of Oregon, in terms of what could be available to a general fund, if at all, whatever that might be.
If you wouldn't want to bring an additional witness up to the table, that would be fine, or go ahead and answer.
No. Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, actually the funds are in statute, was the information that was just stated.
Well, and the interest is credited statutorily to those account owners.
Correct.
So we don't have any discretion. I mean, if it's an account within the general fund, go to the general fund. If it's a local governments get it. So.
Okay.
And we'd be happy to provide you. You can see that.
Well,
Madam Chair, I think it would be worthwhile to the committee to see a breakdown of those numbers and the interest generations and so forth.
But
why don't we invite you up to the table, please, and identify yourself for the record.
Am I? My name is John Kraft. I'm with Oregon State Treasury. All of the interest goes to the general fund unless it's statutorily dedicated to that particular. That was the answer we were mumbling in the back.
Okay. Follow-up, Representative Crowe.
Thank you. I would just ask staff to provide us in the budget documentation of the governor's budget where that accounting for that interest is.
It's in the revenue forecast, yes.
It is. Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And Madam Chair, I would still like to see the breakdown of those interest generations just for posterity's sake. Thank you.
Let me just ask, because I'm looking at Ms. Haglund's face. I'm trying to get a sense of how voluminous the data is that we're requesting, because the co-chairs have been quite clear that if the request of the agency is overwhelming, that we would need to work with the requester as well as the agency to try to put some sideboards up. And you're transmitting to me that you're either perplexed by the question or not quite sure how to format the answer. I don't want you to leave here with an overwhelming response problem. And if that's the case, if you could communicate that back to the professional staff, we'll work with Representative Krupp to get his question defined in a way that is not cumbersome for the agency.
And I appreciate that, Madam Chair. And what I'm going through is, I mean, we are the state's bank. And so we don't, just like your bank doesn't know what an account is for that you have with them personally, nor do we. So my puzzlement is who to best tap for that. So if I appreciate that, if we can work with the professional staff to see the best mechanism to gather that information.
Is that agreeable to you?
It is, Madam Chair. It is not my intention to produce any voluminous amount of material, as we have plenty of that to read as it is. I'm really just looking for a summary of you have $8 billion invested. Mm-hmm. How much of that is government money? What did it earn in short-term interest? How much of that is credited to local governments? How much of it? Just the breakdown in categories. You should be able to put it on one page. Should I'm not looking for anything beyond that.
Let me, though, ask one other question. If in this account you had local government come in with certain you were investing money on their behalf, you'd never know from one month to the next who your customers were, would you? I mean, you could have local government X come in for a period of time, local government X go out for a period of time.
On any particular day, we would know what accounts had money. Yes.
Exactly.
Right.
But month to month, your customer mix in this management fund might differ.
It would differ, and actually, Madam Chair, it would be daily.
Okay.
As funds move in and out.
Okay, before we leave this point, I want to make sure that we're responsive to Representative Krupp's concerns, and perhaps if Representative Krupp and the agency could work through the professional staff to narrow the scope of the question, to be responsive, but to not be cumbersome on the agency.
Great.
Now, Representative Smith.
Thank you. This is going to be a bizarre question, but there's a rationale behind it.
Okay.
The federal.
When you say that in this building, it causes some of us a certain degree of angst.
There's a cringe. The federal government contracts with quite a few nonprofit corporations in which they take federal money, send it to the nonprofits, but then they require certain collateral requirements that these nonprofits can't meet. I'm curious if this body decided to statutorily allow you folks to be recipients of federal deposits for certain types of nonprofits, could that work?
And have us collateral.
And use you folks as the collateral tool. What happens is USDA will send $1 million, let's say, to an EDA, Economic Development Administration, nonprofit corporation, and they say, you now have this $1 million, but you're required to have FDIC or an equal type of collateral on this money. Well, if you're in Heppner, Oregon, with one bank, you can only put the first $100,000 in to be collateralized. Now what do you do with $900,000? You go out and you find nine other banks to deposit your $100,000 into. And it's cumbersome, it's troublesome, and I wonder if there's an opportunity for this to occur. And this isn't just in one county, this is a statewide issue for these Economic Development Administration nonprofits.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, relative to collateralization.
Could you please identify yourself?
Oh, sorry, Darren Bond, Director of Finance for the Oregon State Treasury. Sorry, Madam Chair. The relative to collateralization, that would not be an opportunity for us because it goes back to ownership of the funds, and unless somehow we came under ownership of these monies, which I don't think would be anything the nonprofits would be interested in. But the institutions are prohibited from collateralizing other than for municipal dollars. So I think
that is statutory.
That's a federal regulation.
A federal regulation.
But one possible opportunity is currently we have a bill in that will enable something called the CDRS program in Oregon,
which is a
Certificate of Deposit Account Registry, which would allow I believe, and I'm not completely as certain on this because I haven't thought about the nonprofit. We've looked at it from the local government perspective, but I believe this is available to nonprofits. And they would be able to go into their bank with that $10 million and actually that is the limit of this program, and make a deposit at their local institution in Hermiston. If they're a member of the CDRS network, then that $10 million is spread out in deposits actually across the country in multiple FDIC-insured certificates of deposit. At the same time, a like amount of money, so $9,900,000, comes back into that bank in Hermiston. So they get the benefit for the community of the full amount of that deposit, but at the same time, the entity gets the benefit of 100% FDIC insurance. It's a very positive program.
That is absolutely fabulous. I'm familiar with that program, and that's...
We have enabling legislation in right now.
Will you come visit me on that?
You bet.
Okay. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
That was timely for me.
Good. Perfect.
Thank you.
Timing in life is everything.
Sure. I think we're now on page 14.
Yes, if I may, Madam Chair, to follow on to our discussion about local governments versus state, we might actually be able to address a little bit of a theme of the questions if we can skip to page 16 and then I'll come back to 14. So what you're seeing on these two pages are our banking measures. On page 16 is a breakdown. The top chart is a breakdown of accounts that are in the short-term fund. The clear part of the bar is state agencies, and the dark bar is local government. The bottom chart shows that same fund, the Oregon Short-Term Fund, in terms of dollars. So, again, the clear part of the bar is state agency dollars in the short-term fund, and then the dark bar is local government monies. So at a very high-level roll-up, it does show the differences in those two holders in the $8 billion that's in the short-term fund. From a performance measure standpoint, how we look at this is that state agencies must bank with the state, and their cash needs to be managed at Oregon State Treasury. Local governments, on the other hand, though, do not. They're free to go anywhere. And so their participation in this fund is a validation of the product that we offer to them. So that's the reason that we look at this as a very important measure of the effectiveness of our cash management services. Moving to page 17, specifically looking at banking costs and the costs of the short-term fund, we have two different measures. The measure on the top of page 17 is a measure of the banking transaction fees. And what we have done here is we take a snapshot of a month's activity and run that through our pricing chart of what we charge state agencies. So this is a basket of activities that ran through our program on a particular month. And then we also have that priced out by the banks, so they're shelf pricing. So what you're seeing here is actually over 30 million transactions on an annual basis represented by the left-hand bar. And pricing that through Treasury's pricing model, average per transaction would be 4.4 cents if those same basket of services per transaction were purchased shelf-priced at the banks, 13.5 cents. And translating that into dollars, cost for Treasury, or through Treasury, $3.1 million. Through the banks, $9.3 million. So the advantaged pricing through Treasury's contracts and services, $6.2 million in savings.
That's pricing per transaction. So, but in all fairness, though, to the banking industry, if this was reviewed in terms of a volume type perspective, a lending institute might have an opportunity to come in and to negotiate that and maybe close that gap a little bit. Is that a fair assessment?
Mr. Bond looks as though he has something he'd like to offer. Would you
well,
like
I don't
to
want
back
to
up here with the table one more time?
For the record, I'm Darren Bond, Director of Finance for the Oregon State Treasury. Madam Chair, Representative Smith, these are the rates that we've negotiated with banks versus what the shelf prices for these are.
So it really is an apples for apples comparison.
This really is an apples for apples comparison.
Okay.
Now, I would grant you that some agencies would be able to negotiate reduced prices on some of the services they do procure. I will assure you that they won't negotiate anything like the prices that we have. Furthermore, that they would require them to undertake the contractual management aspect of this that we provide. State agencies have no involvement in any contract management with banks. So we're talking about us having a handful of bank accounts versus if it was out with the state agencies, there would be literally thousands of bank accounts because they would replicate what we have on at Treasury. So
I applaud this. I just wanted to make sure it was an apples for apples.
Because of the nature, honestly, it's the envy of many states across the country, the cash management program that Oregon has, because of the way we have centralized our banking services, being able to still utilize a broad branch bank network that we have in Oregon, a branch banking system that goes back for years, so that we can rapidly get money into the Treasury, be able to work that money very rapidly, but at the same time be able to negotiate prices on an enterprise-wide basis. That's where we can drive the cost down so significantly. We don't even talk to our banks about what their standard pricing is. Banks look at us, the only banks that we're willing to do business with, look at us from an incremental costing basis. I don't care what their all-in cost is. I care about how much it costs to service me and how much profit they can get out of the incremental business they take on from us. It's a fundamentally different way for them to look at pricing, but it still enables them to drive profit and enables us to drive cost savings.
Last quick question. as a follow-up, but a little bit of switching gears, what happens if a local government has an NSF? Do you honor their transaction?
Representative Smith, local governments don't write checks on us. Local governments use us more as a money market account and do a limited amount of electronic funds transfers. There is an occasion where they do overdraft us because of, usually it's timing issues. They expected a deposit in that didn't come in.
So who carries that?
We carry it for a short period of time, but we charge them interest.
You do bill them back. That's
we charge them interest, and we charge them at a slight premium because we look at it as a basically it's a loan from the short-term fund for that period of time. We charge them an overdraft rate of 150 basis points over the current rate for the length of time that they're overdrafted. So they pay it. And state agencies are charged identically for overdrafts.
Thank you.
We don't do anything for free.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
It's a banker.
Do you negotiate similar rates with investment houses who invest a portion of our monies that the Treasury Department manages?
Representative Croft, yes, we do, but I would not be the one to speak to that.
You want Ron to go?
I think we have a very good story to tell you about the fees in which we drive with our partnerships.
Okay.
We've actually done some market analysis of that, and sum total is we have, by industry standards, public work programs, some of the lowest, if not the lowest, cost basis to run the money. Ron?
Hello. My name is Ron Schmitz, Director of the Investment Division. With respect to, again, the gorilla in the room is Oprah at $48 billion, but as stated earlier, we manage other funds as well, up to $60 billion. We do negotiate very hard all the management fees on all of those funds, and as Treasurer Edwards mentioned, we participate in a third-party survey, an independent survey of costs of pension funds relative to our peers across the country. And not only in terms of investment returns are we value added, but we're also considered a low cost provider. An anecdotal bit of information on top of that, the Oregon Investment Council started a new relationship with an independent consultant a little over a year ago. That consultant came in just convinced that they could help us with fee savings by renegotiating investment management fees in all of our contracts, and they came back out of the number of relationships we have with only one that they were able to negotiate a slight improvement in what we had already negotiated at the staff level, and they were astounded.
Mr. Chair?
How much of the $60 billion is invested with outside investment houses? And perhaps I'm thinking in the wrong mindset, and I'll share with you why. Previous to you becoming the state treasurer, I took an early morning tour of the trading pit that you have, for lack of a better term, and met a number of your traders. I guess at the time I was the only legislator to have ever done that. And it's just because I have an interest in this area. And I began to chat with them and listen to stories about how you have individuals who work for us at the state level that manage pretty large sums of portfolios of money, and that you there was one particular gentleman that managed about $1 billion worth of some type of money, and that as an experiment they took about $100 million of that and placed it with an investment house to have them manage it, and they did outstandingly well and charged a commensurate fee, which was several $1 million in management fees. And this particular gentleman was managing, in essence, $900 million for $100,000 salary, which would seem to indicate to me that he was doing an outstanding job for a considerable savings to the taxpayer, in essence, because that the money was earning interest and being credited back to the accounts. How much of the total amounts of money do you manage like that? How much is managed by state employees across the street over here, and how much are you managing with outside investment houses?
Representative Croft, of the $60 billion right now, the only amount managed internally by Treasury personnel is the nearly $9 billion short-term fund. At one point in time in our history, the bond portfolio was managed internally, and I think that's the individual you may be referencing. When he retired a few years back, the Oregon Investment Council made the decision, and I think with Treasury staff at the time, made the decision to take that money to external managers. We do have a very attractive fee on that money, but it is all managed externally now, what once was managed internally by Treasury staff. We do have a bill in front of the in the legislature now that would allow for some of the equity money that we have. Right now there's a prohibition against direct ownership of equities, and we've requested the legislature to act on removing that prohibition so that we could selectively look at managing some money internally. There literally are, as you note, millions of dollars that could be saved by prudent internal management of certain strategies. I don't think we'd ever want to take a lot of money internally or fully active strategies internal, but there is some fee savings to be had with a little more aggressive internal management.
And one last follow-up, Mr. Chair. So are we then – I guess the question I need to ask then by your answer is that are we spending more money by having outside investment houses, even though you've negotiated a very attractive fee, are we still spending more money than what we used to under the old system where you had individuals who were state employees who were investing that amount of money?
I think, Representative Crawford, it depends on how you define the answer to that question. I think with respect to the fee issue alone, yes, by far. It's a much trickier question to ask the cost to answer that in a cost benefit sense, and that is, would the internal portfolio perform as well as the external portfolio? And that's really the key. I think the performance was very strong of the individual that you referenced in your earlier comments, and probably returns did compare favorably at a much lower cost. But that's always the balancing act, and that's why, as I mentioned, we would probably only take certain strategies internal. If the legislature approves the initiative we have in front of it, that there are only certain strategies that we've ever taken internally, because they would be the ones that we would expect to have a beneficial cost-benefit ratio.
Could I just add,
please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, I mean, the decision on this one case about moving to an external management with the bond portfolio, it really was a strategy. We're always sensitive to cost, but there's also a risk. We had one individual managing, in fact, the number was closer to $10 billion, if I'm not mistaken.
When
he left, it was $10 billion. And we had to really make a judgment on, so do we find a replacement? One, could we find a replacement? And then the risk to that asset with one person. And we thought we ended up hiring five debt managers to run that portfolio with a long-term investment strategy. And even this individual said that this market has changed so dramatically. We need more the state need more resources, and that's where our model has always worked, of finding those private sector partners that have much greater depth than we do. We don't have a tower in the state. We recognize that we're very lean. But to execute our mandate, we find those people that can do that business for us and can drive our costs down as low as we can. So this was a strategy that was appropriate. And again, it is sort of an apples to oranges or bananas, because quite frankly, this gentleman had been there years and years, done a fantastic job. But it was a long-term strategy. We had to change the management. It had gotten too large.
Did you have anything else?
No,
Smith?
Well, I think she...
If I may just add
to that, the proposal that we have in front of the legislature to allow us to invest in-house in equities, I just want to make it very clear that the portfolio has a large position in equities currently, but they're managed by external managers. And a play on the same theme of the dollars saved in managing the fixed income portfolio in the past, we're looking at the equities portfolio and can we, within reasonable ability to have internal resources, balance that risk return, balance that ability to have adequate staffing to handle that. We'd like to be able to bring some of that money in-house and manage some of those portfolios to get back to that same fee savings of a state person versus an outside money manager.
Thank you, Chair Morris. This question is directed to you, Treasurer Edwards. First, let me say thank you for the good work that you are doing. And
thank you.
I want you to know that District 57 truly appreciates the time you spend in reaching out to them.
Thank you.
I think that's a real testament to your leadership. Something to have folks in Troy, Oregon know who their state treasurer is. Question I have for you is you're dealing with a very, very talented and competent staff. That's obvious. How do you keep your turnover from skyrocketing?
Right.
How do you keep yourself from being a training ground or even...
That's a great question.
How do you keep folks with you, knowing the industry you're in?
Right. That's a... Mr. Chair.
We could hear that all the way up here.
Yeah. She made your life fun.
Representative, first, thank you very much for that compliment. It is a team effort, and I'm standing on shoulders of the past, of past treasurers, past organizations. I keep underscoring that we have a national reputation. It is true. It is true that people want to have Oregon on their list of clients. Not because, obviously, they want the people are looking for money, but it's a mantle of achievement. We get people all the time coming to the state looking to be part of our program. Turnover has been an issue, and I think part of it is we like many state agencies, saw PERS and the changes in PERS. A lot of people decided for them personally that it was time to move on. The Treasury's been blessed in many ways as being a place where people come to want to work for a long time. That actually has changed. On my watch, though, we've had a number of changes, and some of the people here are brand new in my exec management level. And we've done national searches. We've tried to find good people, and I believe we have a really good team. It is challenging. We're, in fact, in the process of losing one of our real estate investors because he can see that he can make a lot more money outside. And that will happen. He's a very talented person. He's been here for 6 years. As you know, our generation tends to want to maybe move on anyway. My goal is to make sure I'm working with you that we have a budget that, one, meets the needs of the state, but also that we have a proactive approach to making sure we have good employees and compensation's one of them. Good work environment. We work really hard at keeping people trained. I mean, again, we're a very lean organization, but we put a lot of effort into training our people, keeping them up to speed in what's happening in their industry, giving them growth opportunities and try to move them within the Treasury. So that's how we've maintained that status.
Just a quick follow-up on that, and I guess this is more a compliment than anything else, but you know, if you look at Mike Bellotti, he has a large salary, and it's based upon comparable worth. You know, he fills Otson and, you know, sells time and therefore gets more money. I'm willing to bet, though, if you look at the folks in your department and the cash they're managing and the returns they're bringing to the state of Oregon, if you use that same comparative worth model, there's going to be a deficiency there. And I don't know what the solution is. I guess other than saying thank you to your staff and hopefully somehow one day we can recognize that, because you hate to bring folks in who know the system, know how to work in it, know how to maximize returns for the state of Oregon, and then have them financially decide they need to leave.
So. You're not suggesting we pay him the cost of a college football coach, I hope.
No. I'm fiscally conservative, but I recognize comparable worth, and you have talent.
Although the return on a dollar in Treasury probably is a little bit more than the athletic coach.
Right. Yeah, I'm welcome.
Yes. Yeah.
But thank you. That's it. Thank you.
We'll get to your salary right after we deal with the legislature.
Okay.
Salary.
Okay. Yeah, but I'm speaking to the choir here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just going to make that comment. I think your salary is considerably more than, you used to be in this body,
I know the charity work.
Yes, indeed. How do we compare? I'm just curious, in talking about this issue of internal investing, and I am intrigued at it, how do we compare with other states who manage large sums of money? New York and Pennsylvania and Michigan, California, that have massive portfolios of investment. How do they do this a lot also, or do they outsource it all? Or how do we compare?
How the money is managed?
Yes, yeah. Do we internally, externally? How do we compare?
Actually, we've just recently done a survey.
You have, okay.
To answer that, so we'll have Ron come back up.
Mr. Chair, if I may, is it a survey that you could share with the committee?
Sure. Once again, Ron, for the record, Ron Schmitz, Director, Investment Division. The answer to the question, it's really mixed across states. Most of the larger states do manage a fair portion of their assets internally. I don't remember which committee it was, but within the last few weeks we were asked that question and did a quick survey, and I'd be happy to make it available. But in that survey, we got responses from 21 states across the country. I believe, if I remember the number correctly, the average was 62% of the portfolios were managed internally, and it ranged from about 5% up to 100%. But virtually all the large states do a fair amount of internal management. But a lot of states, particularly some of them are, California, for example, are two or three times, what our size is, and New York, but some smaller states as well. But we'll be happy to make that data available to you.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, what's our percentage then is managed internally? Sounds like it's actually pretty small right now.
Yes, Representative, it would be about 12-13%, I guess, if you look at $9 billion short-term fund versus the $60 billion, 15%, I guess that is.
15%. And lastly, could you, Mr. Chair, if I may, could you provide us with a list of those who are the outside companies that manage our portfolios?
In our annual report.
Oh, it is. Yeah. Okay.
Great, thank you.
Sir.
We'll get back to you, but I would like to at least draw attention to the clock. It's 10 o'clock, and we will adjourn at 10:30, and I want to make sure that we get through the material because the treasurer has other commitments and will not be back tomorrow. So just let's manage our time to the 30 minutes allotted and make sure that we cover what you feel is most important.
Chair Morrison, in light of that, I'll hold my question.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, I might ask for some guidance there. We're in the middle of the performance measures. I'll go ahead and continue with that. What we haven't talked about yet, just to look forward then, is the 10% reduction. So that's do you have a preference there? I wouldn't mind doing just very quickly touching on the College Savings Network, because that is a new program.
On page 18? Yes, please.
18 and 19. Again, just because it is a new program, I wanted you to see graphically some of the results actually out in the marketplace. On page 18, that top graph shows the network itself. And on the left axis is the dollars in the program. The right axis is the number of accounts. So the left axis is the bars. The right axis is the line. And I think you can see there that the program, we have said it's a very attractive program out in the marketplace, and I think there's a direct representation here of the dollars and the accounts in the program that as our vendors, as well as Michael Parker, the executive director of the program, have gotten out across the state and gotten the word out, you've seen that ramp up very quickly in the deposits coming into the program. We do have a customer survey result in that bottom graph, and it is the first time that the network has done a survey, and they asked a question amongst others. This one is, how we doing? Do you like the program? And it was directed to the direct-only customers because they're the ones that have choice to pick any program across the country, and you can see the zero was don't like it to a high of four for a score of liking the program and feeling that it was serving their needs, and we're at over 3.5. So it's being very well received by the individuals who are in the program voluntarily. I won't go through the performance of the program itself. Just like we did in the investment division, going through the sub-asset classes of the OPERF portfolio, what you see in these charts is the actual returns of the various portfolio mixes. And it's the same methodology there, the actual return of those mixes relative to the benchmarks for each mix. So unless you had questions specific to those, I won't go into them. Okay. And if I could quickly, we did skip debt management measures. If you wanted me to go through those, that's on page 14 and 15. If there's anything specific that you had there. Okay. Let me turn then to tab 4, which is starting on page 23.
There was a... I wonder, maybe Treasurer, if you would comment on the sudden increase in debt, net tax-supported debt per capita, your reflections on what's happening in trend,
sure.
and what kind of risks you think we're encountering.
Linda can add to this, and we have my debt manager is here as well, so if you need more information, but just high level, you do see that profile on page 14, the top bar chart, and then both the bar chart of actual outstanding debt per capita and then the Moody's, which is a rating agency, so their median capita, they're tracking across the state, across the country of all states. You see there's a fair amount of growth starting in 2000,
up to 2004, and those last 2 years really reflect, it's unfortunate we didn't put this in color, but I guess we're saving money for printing. But if you really, those two last bar charts really reflect the pension obligation bond that we sold. It was a $2 billion bond. And that really, as you recall, was a play against the cost that we had it fixed in the PERS system at 8%. We got money much cheaper than that, and we've arbitraged that in the sense that we've invested that fully and have done. Those 2 years proved to be extremely good years as well. So it was a good play. And long term, this, I think, we will see the savings that we anticipated of up to $1 billion, the difference over time. But that's why that chart spiked at the end there.
Question. Is that total debt or annual debt service? In terms of when I'm looking at it and I go across and I see $680,000, is that the total debt? That's my contribution to the state. Is
the total debt outstanding per capita?
Okay, so it's not annual debt service.
No.
Okay, it's not my share per year.
It's your share of the debt outstanding.
Got it. Thank you.
Right. Thank you.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, to clarify, because now Representative, you got me confused. that is $600 of debt per capita, which means per person, man, woman, child.
In the state.
In the state, that's $600, not $600,000, not $6,000, just $600.
It is what it is, yeah.
Okay, all right. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And the rating agencies just came out on a rating of a recent sale, and some include that pension obligation bond, some don't, and if you net that out, actually we're still on the low side per capita.
So every time I have a kid, they start out $680 in debt. Oh, okay.
Have more children.
Trying to help here.
And if I might follow on, the reason that the rating agencies do pull out pension obligation bond issuances is the actual obligation of the state or the local government that the rating is already there. Selling the bond just changes where it appears on their balance sheet.
Mr. Chair?
And I would assume that you would expect in future years for this incline to go down or to flatten out, because this is a bit of an anomaly because of the sale of the bonds. Is that correct?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vakian, actually it may go down for the pension bonds as they're sold off. However, there is a large amount of transportation bonds that are still yet to be issued. Mm-hmm. So I... So no, I don't see it.
No.
I don't see it going back way down.
The one thing, too, and I should add a little color here as well, interest rates have been so historically low. Mm-hmm. We collectively as a state and the legislature, really this has been a good time to refinance bonds that we have outstanding, issue more debt, more bonds, to build infrastructure that we've been needing at the lowest cost possible. So that also played to why you saw, particularly in the 01, 02, and 03, 04, rates going up.
Thank you. Just briefly, have we sold any of those transportation bonds for OTA 3?
I think we just started that.
Laura, this is our newest member of our team. We got to have her come up here.
Well, no offense, I lived there a couple of years also, so.
No one can get in California as much as the former. For the record, through the chair, my name is Laura Lockwood McCall, and I've been with Treasury now just under 6 months. My understanding is prior to my arrival, we sold the first series of OTA 3 bonds for the local portion of OTA 3, but we have not yet begun to sell the bonds for the state portion, and that will occur over the next probably decade. We need to balance out the ability of the Department of Transportation to actually implement the transactions. We can't sell more bonds than they could actually construct. Under federal law, there's a you need to spend the money in 3 years. At the same token, we're going to fine-tune. We want to make sure we have good coverage because we only have a limited amount of revenue. So we're trying to sort of balance out getting the work done, what they could actually accomplish that we could certify in advance, and keep our coverage level strong so that we don't unduly dilute the credit, if you will. So we want to maintain a strong credit rating so we get a very favorable interest rate.
Sure. Okay, because now I am further confused. And so I hope that you can set me straight. We passed out of this body in 2003 the OTIA-3 package. And shortly thereafter, then the fee increases associated with that went into effect. So for a period of time now, the state has been collecting money from the OTIA-3 fee increases, yet we have not sold the bonds, in essence, on the state portion yet to do the work that OTIA-3 is destined to accomplish. So where's that money going? And is it being set aside for the debt service of these bonds?
Yes, through the chair and Representative Croft. The money is collected, and again, being a new person, I've been involved in one transaction. If I use layperson's terms, I may not get all the fund names correct. But my understanding is that all of the funds come into the Department of Transportation. There's a series of bucket drops, and it's a fairly complex set of bucket drops to cover debt service for existing debt. There's portions that get allocated out of all the fees and charges that the state collects for local governments, and then there's monies that you're talking about that have been allocated towards these projects. That revenue stream of increased fees is going to be an annual number that covers annual debt service costs. Under our bond indentures, it's not a dollar-for-dollar thing where each dollar goes to pay each dollar debt service. There's coverage requirements because when you look at it from the investor's perspective, there's variations in fuel taxes and fees. And so we have coverage requirements. In our indenture, it's a 4x coverage factor. It's a very bare minimum. So for every $100 million raised, $25 million of debt service. And then there's other dollars that go in that will pay on a pay-as-you-go basis for construction projects. So it's a common in operating costs of the department. I hope I'm not confusing you further. But right now, our coverage is fairly high. My understanding is there's all sorts of projects that are in various stages of development. There's monies that are being used for early planning. There's monies that are for early levels of construction. And there's things that are being completed. $1.6 billion of state projects are in various phases of development. Our goal is to sell roughly $300 million a year, each year for the next several years. The debt service will then start accumulating, and the revenues are available then to meet all of those various needs. And our goal is that we will be a fairly strong clip later this fiscal year. We're just trying to balance out not issuing all $1.6 billion at the same time. Our revenues wouldn't be sufficient to cover that. We want growth over time to also help us to make sure that we have that good coverage level.
Well, now, Madam Chair, confused because we voted for a large package of increases based on fees, and we were told that those fee increases would fund OTIA-3. And if I'm hearing what you just said correctly, and please feel free to correct me and set me straight, we should, in my mind anyway, I guess, and from a farmer's perspective, if the fee increases were necessary to fund $2.4 billion worth of bond sales?
1.9, I believe.
Okay. $1.9 billion, then it would, in my mind, it would seem that we should be able to sell $1.9 billion, and the fees that we're collecting that are increased to cover that ought to be able to cover that. So I'm confused.
Well,
Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, this would be a good question to also have the Transportation Department answer.
That's just, I'm going to exercise a prerogative of the chair here in a second and say this is also an ODOT question. These guys are the bankers. Those guys are the project managers. And as it appears, unless we move expeditiously through the last 15 minutes, we are going to have to ask you to come back tomorrow. to conclude, and if we can arrange it, have somebody from ODOT come in and comment on this question, if you don't mind waiting until tomorrow.
I'm fine with that, Madam Chair. Okay. I really think we ought to get this clarified, because this is not what I was... This is not why I voted for OTIA 3. It's not my understanding of how things were going to happen.
I think there may be some additional comment that you all might want to prepare on the wisdom of a bond sale of that magnitude versus your desire to do the bond sale incrementally.
Just to answer that briefly, you couldn't do it. The department's not ready. We legally can't just sit on $1.9 billion and just wait. But there is a cash issue here, and we'll get our answer, and I think ODOT would have an answer as well for it.
Hey, Representative Smith, are you changing the subject, or are you in the
same but very
please,
quick.
Go ahead.
What I would share with the good representative is there was a rational explanation. I've worked through this issue. It would take us a half hour to get through
okay.
it. The one thing though, because four of us serve on the Transportation Ways and Means. Can you put together just kind of a one-page risk analysis for the committee talking about the effect the interest rates would have on the cost of the project, meaning rates go up, less cash available to fund projects, or at least the cost of the borrowings would be more.
Sure. As rates, interest rates go
yeah,
up.
Yeah, so that way in 4 years, if all of us are gone, you know, the next legislature would be able to say, oh, this was the rationale. Now rates have gone up here. Do we still want to do the last bond sales?
Big picture, as you said, Madam Chair, we're the finance piece. You got ODOT and policy that you've all set. And we're working closely with ODOT to make sure from a financial point of view we're doing this in the smartest way to stretch those fees and make sure we meet the needs that you set out.
But just really quick, but you folks are the bankers, and they're the project managers. Anyone who's gone to the bank knows the project manager is going to tell you and put this in the best possible picture. The banker's the rational one who says, yeah, but what if? And so I want to know the yeah, but what ifs.
Okay, once again, I'm going to exercise the prerogative of the chair. We're going to try to finish your presentation today. I'm thinking of the expense of bringing you all back. You've got work to do. And so I would ask the treasurer and your very capable staff to get with ODOT, get the explanation to the satisfaction of Representative Krupp and Representative Smith, and filter it again through the professional staff if you need anything. Satisfactory,
that's
gentlemen?
That's fine. Thank you very much.
Okay, Ms. Hagelin.
So,
press
on,
ahead.
On tab 4, page 23% reductions. I think that could help you along in your timing. These are all critical programs to the state, and we don't think that it would be appropriate and worthwhile dollar savings to take 10% cuts. If you'd like me to proceed from there, I can.
I think all of us can read. Anybody have any questions about this display?
No.
I would once again commend you on the clarity of the display. Not all agencies have made it quite as clear in the display format, and this is very useful.
Thank you.
You've forgotten my good friend Ock Ed again. But any questions?
No.
Okay.
And
that concludes.
And that's, yes.
Okay.
Right.
Dallas, any comments from a staff perspective?
One thing, Madam Chair. In the prior session, we informally went through the performance measures. I think when we get into work session for the treasurer, we need to formally adopt them, if you will. That was one of the key issues we want to get on the table today was a review and vetting of their performance measures, and if this committee is comfortable with the performance measures that the department, that the treasurer's office has presented.
The only question I guess I would ask, given that you have so many fund managers and different professional consultants coming in and out of your shop, I would assume that at some point this level of performance management has been vetted by some of them, or you're basing some of your performance against, say, the Russell 3000. I'm looking for some level of reassurance that in terms of sort of peer-reviewed, or if any of your consultants have looked at these, do they have a comment that you're tracking the right sort of indicators that would allow the legislature or any of your customers or any of your consultants to look at this display and say, this is a lean, well-managed shop that is meeting certain metrics? Have you gotten any feedback from any other state organizations that compare Treasury performance against national reference norms? Can you give us any insight into to the level of peer vetting that has gone into your performance metrics?
We could get that for you. You know, it's interesting because I still go to conferences where I have my colleagues who are jumping up and down. They finally got authority to invest in the stock market, and we've been in it since the early 70s. You know, Oregon has a long history here, so yes, we can find some peer reviews. I guess my point with that is we really look at our peer review as the benchmarks that we set out in the private industry. I threw out through Pensions Investors how we rank just in size versus our other public and private funds out there in the pension world. But these benchmarks, I guess, as I mentioned earlier, we set them out, and we set them out for every manager, and we watch them. And if for whatever reason they're not performing as we expect, we will put them on a watch list. And we often have, we've had a lot of turnover in our managers because they're not performing as we thought, not only we, but collectively with my staff and the consultants that advise us in these areas, that they no longer manage our money.
Representative Smith. Thank you. Treasurer Edwards, you're the chairman of the board and also the president. You're responsible to the folks you work with, to the investment community, and also to the voters of Oregon. And under that analogy, I guess we're kind of on your board with you, and you're our chair. You have access to the internal audits that are conducted, I assume, by an internal auditor. Are those doubt
for whom you mean?
For the Treasury Department.
Yeah.
Okay. Dallas, have you had an opportunity to look at the internal audits?
I haven't. I haven't asked to. I have in prior times looked at external reviews that have been conducted.
See, my issue is, again, it goes back to my financial background. I'm more interested in knowing that Oregonians' investments are safe. Can I get any internal audits that have been conducted by your internal auditor?
How many do you want? We're audited by the Secretary of State. We rotate big four accounting firms. There's what's left of them through. So we have external review, internal review.
I'm more interested in the internal.
Sure.
Your internal auditor and what they see and what they came up with.
Sure.
Senator Morse.
Maybe a copy of the management letter would be
right. Yeah.
Adequate.
Thank
sure.
you.
That'd be easy.
And you had a question in addition to that comment.
If Senator Smith is.
Hold on.
Thank you. To what extent does the benchmark or the performance measures here coincide and reflect what you would use in your investment council, your board would use for performance measures?
That's what I was trying to ask. Thank you for helping with that.
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, one for one. These are the adopted.
These are
this is what we adopt.
Okay. Correct.
This is who we hold it.
Correct.
That was what I was hoping you would say.
And my staff, and I mean, they're overseeing these people, and their job is to watch them if they're just either swaying away from those benchmarks or style-wise moving away, and we do have turnover.
And to be clear, the benchmarks themselves, while there may be names that you're not familiar with, the S&P 500 is probably a benchmark, an industry benchmark that we're all familiar with. These are of the same caliber. It's a different set of benchmarks, but they're the same industry standard that we have no control over. They're totally set by an outside body, and the returns are calculated by an outside body.
That was very helpful, and thank you for putting a more nuanced point on what I was stumbling around with. As part of phase two, it's actually phase one and a half, I think will be the committee's interest in acknowledging and validating the performance measures. And unless any of you object, I think that I hear a certain consensus formulated, beginning to be formulated, that these are adequate performance measures and adequately reflect the performance of the Treasury. I would invite any of your concerns, either in written or advanced now, but I'm trying to get a feeling of consensus for the committee if on these performance measures we can arrive at an agreement that these are adequate measures.
The only thing I wanted to see, Madam Chair, was the comparison of the OPIR fund in terms of returns versus total asset. A side-by-side chart comparison would be fine. But that's the only thing I'm going to see.
That's good. Senator Morse.
If we have just a couple of minutes.
Yes, we do have a couple of minutes.
Let's turn to page 22. The training and education appears to be the one benchmark that has fallen, or no, the performance measure has fallen below your goal. And it's been quite consistent. Either the goal is too high or the dedication to meeting the goal is not present. Could you comment?
Well, 20 hours per year, Madam Chair, Senator Morse, I don't know if we've actually set a target within the 20 hours. So your assumption is the chart would say that we're wanting to achieve 100% of every employee having 20 hours of training.
Well, that maybe you could explain what the performance measure is then.
Mm-hmm. We do have that as an objective. We haven't gone in and said what the minimum standard is. We do strive to always hit that 100%. The 20 hours a year is a pretty lofty objective, and rather than ratchet back the 20 hours to a more reasonable, you can see over time, if we took an average of the number of hours, rather than ratchet that back to something that we could hit 100%, we'd prefer to keep it at a 20-hour objective by the employee to continue to push them to get more training. So almost a little bit of an unreachable goal, if you will, to keep pushing training.
Is that responsive?
Reasonably. But I think that's fine.
Madam Chair? In looking at the performance measure just above that, Treasury customer satisfaction, who are your customers?
Our customers are the entities that use our services, so state agencies, local governments that use the services we've talked about. We do provide some products in the debt management area for local governments and their debt issuances, so this would be financial advisors, bond councils that are issuing bonds for local governments.
And lastly, Madam Chair, if I may, what does the number on the left-hand page or the portion of that graph, what does that represent? That's 0 to 5, 5 meaning what?
Unhappy, very satisfied.
Oh, okay. So instead of 0 to 10, you use a 0. It's
exactly.
Just it's just a measurement device.
Yes,
okay.
And I will have to say 2003 is blank because we were busy and our customers were busy, and we just did not do a survey that year for that reason.
Representative Abakian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to the chart that Senator Morse was asking mm-hmm. about, the thing that's difficult with the analysis here, as it has been with other measurements that we've had to review, is that one would have to assume that you think to perform adequately, your employees should have 20 hours of education, and that therefore they're not getting their 20 hours of education, and that might be affecting their performance in some way. But I don't know if that's what you're really telling us.
Madam Chair, Senator, or Representative Vaki, and I just promoted you. My apologies.
Why, thank you. There is an open chair on the other side.
Some of us don't see it as a promotion.
Yeah.
Well put, Representative.
And I think, you know, you have touched on one of the challenges in measures. To set a target out that is universal for the agency and trying to balance then for each individual what is an appropriate amount of training for that particular staff, as well as how do we most cost effectively use our dollars. And it's tough.
I would just like to know, do you think your folks are getting the training they need to do the job they need to do?
or should I look at this and say they're not?
Madam Chair, Representative Ivanka, yes, they are, as long as we have the dollars available to fund that training for them.
Okay. Thank you. Following on this exchange, I think maybe we'd flag this one for some additional discussion in phase two, but beyond that, I think you hear consensus around the committee that your other metrics are agreeable as performance measures. Unless there is any additional comment from the committee, and seeing none, I am going to adjourn the public hearing on House Bill 5071. And given that we have concluded in a day, Dallas, we have nothing scheduled.
Right. Chairman, the Employment Relations Board was originally...